think what the writer has to do is pass the baton and know that the actor is going to do their thing with it, and you can't have the ownership of it or you're going to be unhappy. You need to pass it and know it's going to be something else out in the world. And not only with just the actor, but as things move out into the world, they're hitting like the zeitgeist of the time. And that's changing the work. You know, people's perceptions of the work changes the work itself. So I think you have to let go.
Welcome to Deviate with Rolf Potts. Today's episode takes you behind the scenes of the classic 1995 travel movie Before Sunrise, and it features an interview with Kim Curzon, who co-wrote the screenplay with director Richard Linklater. This film is about a young American guy and a young French woman who meet on a train in Austria and decide to get off the train together in the city of Vienna.
Now I'm going to call my best friend in Paris, who I'm supposed to have lunch with in 8 hours. Okay?
Okay.
Ring, ring. Pick up the phone.
Hello?
I don't think I'm going to be able to make it for lunch today. I'm sorry. I met a guy on the train and I got off with him in Vienna. We're still there.
Are you crazy?
Probably.
You might recall that in episode 256 of this podcast, I spontaneously invited Kim Curzon to teach a screenwriting class in Paris, where I run a series of travel memoir classes each summer. Kim said yes, and 4 months later, we had the Q&A session you'll hear in this episode. Kim is having the screenwriting class in Paris again this August, and you can find more about this in the show notes or at pariswritingworkshops.com. This class covers all aspects of screenwriting, not just the movie Kim is famous for. And in fact, students are only allowed to ask her about Before Sunrise as part of a Zoom session we hold over wine and cheese after the first day of class. There's actually a video version of today's episode online at YouTube. You can find it linked at the show notes at rolfpotts.com/deviate, or you can find it online at my Rolf Potts YouTube channel. This conversation ends up being a fascinating peek into the creation of a movie from the writing perspective. Along the way, Kim and my Paris students talk about how the script was written with the idea that it might be an ambitious failure. Kim talks about how the movie was cast and how some of the original actresses they considered for the part included people like Lily Taylor and Robin Wright. She talks about what it feels like when an actor embodies a character you based on yourself and what happens when the actor's character decisions differ from your own. She talks about how some of the myths about what inspired the movie might not be completely true. She starts by talking about how she got involved with collaborating on the script after her experiences of acting in Linklater's movies Dazed and Confused and Slacker. Let's listen in.
Richard Linklater asked me to, he wanted to read something that I had written. I auditioned for the movie Slacker. As my audition for the movie Slacker, and this is in the late 80s, he just asked me what I was doing with my life, and I told him I was working on a master's thesis on Anna Eastman, the Diarist. And he put me in Slacker, and then later he put me in Dazed and Confused, but he kept asking me if he could read my master's thesis. I gave it to him on a Monday. He called me on Tuesday and asked if he could meet the next day. And I went into this restaurant and he had my master's thesis sitting there. And he said, would you write a movie with me? And I said, I've never written a movie before. And he said, it doesn't matter. I can see that you can write. And I said, well, what kind of a movie? And he said, a boy meets girl movie. And I said, okay, well, so we got together some months later. I think he was finishing wrapping up the post-production in Dazed and Confused. We got together in my house sometime later. All we knew is that we were going to write together probably a boy meets girl. We didn't know anything else. We had our notebooks. We were taking notes and brainstorming on, you know, things to talk about. But I noticed that his movies took place in a finite period of time. You know, Slacker takes place in about a 24-hour period. Same thing with Dazed and Confused. And so I said, hey, you know what? I've traveled alone by train. And it's really interesting when you're traveling alone in a foreign place that you meet someone and you hang out with them for a finite period of time, or you have a conversation for a finite period on the train and then you part ways. That seems to go along with your idea of beginnings and endings that are pretty tight, you know? And so he said, great, that's it. That's our little framework there. So we then brainstormed for days on what a couple would talk about. Fortunately, Richard Linklater and I were really into conversation. We really enjoyed talking and, you know, talking about the books we were reading or philosophies we had, or, you know, we'd heard this or that, a funny story, something from our past. And so it was very natural for us to just talk all night. And so we were recording things in our notebooks, just brainstorming like crazy. And then at a certain point, we realized that we had enough material to start crafting a script. And we were thinking about the natural progression if a boy were to meet a girl on a train and they liked each other and wanted to spend time together and maybe got off the train to do some sightseeing in a place. How would the conversation go? I mean, when you have that sort of situation and it's finite and you know you're going to part ways and you know you're probably never going to see the person again, it's the ticking clock. It's like you're not going to mince words. You're going to take more risks in your conversation. Why not? If you don't like them, you can go. You can just split. We were thinking about this situation in which people are walking around together and maybe they're starting to like one another more and more over the course of the night. How's it going to end? And this is before the internet. So back then, it was quite difficult to stay in touch with people. It was very expensive to make a phone call, you know, an overseas phone call, or, you know, any kind of like long distance phone call. And so how would these people stay in touch? It was expensive to travel. And so, you know, it was probably going to be a one-time thing. When we started writing together in his apartment at his computer, it was the first time I ever worked on a computer. It was 1993 that we were working on this, spring of 1993. He said, let's just say this is going to be an ambitious failure. See, I didn't know. I had never worked on a screenplay or been involved in film except for being in his two movies as an actress with no training. And I didn't know how difficult it was to get things made. It's very, very, very difficult. And so he told me basically, don't count on this getting made. And so I kept that in mind. Maybe we're just having fun. I think that's a good way to work, is that you're just having an interesting experience. We generally got together and worked all night. You know, he would sit down and type something and I would sit down and type something and he would sit down like we were having a conversation. And that's how the script for Before Sunrise came about.
All right, Kim, my question is, after sunrise, does Jesse repay the bartender for the bottle of wine he was gifted?
What do you think?
I think when he went back 6 months later, he would have.
He goes back to the bar and he gives the bartender, and the same bartender is there, and he reminds the bartender and gives him the money for the wine.
I hope so. I see so much of myself in him, and I would have, and I think he would have too.
Okay. Well, then he does it.
My man.
Is that in keeping with his character and personality?
Given the fact that she didn't show, I think he probably needed and wanted a win. And I think that displays like the trueness and the authenticity of the reason why he would have went back.
Okay.
I think it's a fair representation.
Okay. I think that's credible. Yeah, I think that's credible. I love that too. I love the romance of that.
Yeah.
I love the fact that he made a promise and he kept it. I think you're right. They're all snapping.
You just made the last 30 years of my life.
My question was about this, the creative process and collaborating not only with Richard, but with Ethan and Julie, because obviously these films are very dialogue driven. What does that process look like of, you know, with working with the actors where, you know, maybe they're also making some rewrites and changes based on what's happening in the moment while they're filming?
Richard Linklater and I wrote Before Sunrise. And then we wrote Before Sunset. And then the actors came in and they contributed ideas, and they contributed enough that we were willing to share the credits. And I don't think it's unusual now for actors to have more input. And so they contributed after Richard Linklater and I had written, say, Before Sunset, and they came in and contributed ideas, possibly based on real feelings, you know? So we laid the groundwork, we laid the foundation, and then they came in and embroidered some on top of that. It gets into a touchy area because people get pretty possessive of their work, you know? But that's basically what happened with Before Sunset. Yeah.
What an amazing opportunity to talk about Before Sunrise, which is probably one of the most epic films of our generation. I have a question about the start scene of the film, which starts with a couple that are quarreling in German. Was it a conscious choice or was it by accident? And also, why would you make this choice for a scene as an opening scene? Because I feel like it sets a movie in such a contrast and a great, great expectation that this couple will never quarrel.
Oh.
But that's just my imagination. So I just wanted to hear from you about this choice of opening of the film.
Richard Linklater and I wrote this 32 years ago. So let me try to remember. Something that I remember my mother saying was that as couples get older, they can't really hear one another. And it was kind of a joke that my parents had. I think she was making a joke about how couples irritated one another. And there's something actually about the hearing where men are supposed to lose some of their hearing on one end and women on the other end. And so they're kind of canceling each other out. And so I believe I told that story to Rick, and we thought maybe we can just create that situation where a couple is arguing, you know, they've been together for a certain number of years. And, you know, we're trying to show what very often happens in relationships, you know. I heard in studying psychology, I heard that the first phase of love is that couples are facing one another and they're absorbed in one another. And that the next phase is they start to individuate. They start to find the ways that they are different. And that phase can last a very long time. And that the next phase is they're heading in the same direction together, but they're no longer at odds. And so I think the couple who are arguing, I believe they're still in that individuating. They're irritating one another. And obviously, when Jesse and Celine meet, they're in that just like melding, yeah. Yes. I mean, we give glimpses of differences, and like they even ask each other, what would irritate you about me? What would be the first thing? And no, I'm not going there.
So earlier, mine's also about the opening scene. Earlier, you were talking about how you and Richard Linklater would talk about the books you were reading. So I was wondering what went into the thought process behind the two books that Julia and Ethan are reading when they first meet on the train.
So I had Celine reading Anna Eastman, because that is basically the origin story of my working with Rick, is that Let's see, we're talking about the early 90s here. I was working on a master's thesis on the diarist Anna Eastman. Julie didn't like Anna Eastman, and she brought in the other novel. I don't like that choice myself, but I just don't think that fits the character. But I think you have to pick your battles when you're collaborating with people and know that you don't want to go to war over, something like that. I felt very strongly about Anna Eastman. I felt that that was the character.
Do you feel very like Celine is like a version of yourself? Because I know you obviously have a big attachment to Artis, however you say the name, and you wanted her to read that book.
Yeah. Yeah. I think that I believe that to a great degree, Celine is based on me. Jesse is based on Richard Linklater. And I think that then the Julie Delpy entered into things and gave her flavor to Celine. And Ethan Hawke came in and gave his sort of angle on the Jesse character. So, yeah, I mean, to a great degree, I think, on Celine.
It's interesting. When you watch the movies, the actors both feel like, at least with Ethan Hawke, it feels very like he is Jesse and the like he's so like that feels like him in real life. And that's like his type of person. And same with Celine. So it's interesting to hear that you feel like you, when you first wrote it, you related to it so much and it was based off of you.
So did you say that you felt like the character was Julie?
Yeah, I think especially with Ethan Hawke, less so Julie, I felt like really like I couldn't imagine that being like Richard Linklater. I feel like that's so Ethan Hawke, and that's how I picture Ethan Hawke in real life.
Well, I'm imagining that Ethan was cast to a large degree because he and Rick were simpatico.
Yeah, I mean, and they do so many works together still. So yeah,
they're both smart guys. They're well-read guys. I think they have a similar sense of humor. I think they have a similar kind of skepticism.
Yeah.
And I think that it really worked to have Ethan Hawke cast as Jesse.
And just, this is a little personal, but does that add some like rivalry between the people if you're bringing in these two other people and you relate so much to Celine when you first wrote it and then you're bringing in this other person who's like embodying this person you created and is changing it?
I think that if you talk to the original writer, they're always, I mean, I'm thinking right now of Isherwood, who wrote Cabaret, which is one of the most wonderful movies in the entire world. He wrote Cabaret about Sally Bowles. Is that not one of the greatest movies? And he was so disappointed because he said, that's not Sally Bowles. Sally Bowles wasn't this brilliant singer. She was, I mean, they completely changed the character. So I think what the writer has to do is pass the baton and know that the actor is going to do their thing with it and you can't have the ownership of it or you're going to be unhappy. You need to pass it and know it's going to be something else out in the world. And not only with just the actor, but as things move out into the world, they're hitting like the zeitgeist of the time. And that's changing the work. You know, people's perceptions of the work changes the work itself. So I think you have to let go, completely let go. And I believe I did that to a large degree. I think that I let go.
Hi,
Isaac.
I think relatedly, I was going to ask you about casting, actually, and if you had anyone in mind while you were writing it, if you personally are happy with the casting, if you can share, and then if you had anyone else, you know, in retrospect that you had in mind as, you know, options two or three.
Okay, I can talk a little bit about that. We did not know it would be made in Europe. We thought it was going to be made in America, and we thought it was probably going to be on Amtrak. The conversations could have taken place anywhere, in any like river walk, in any cemetery, in any cafe, in any bar, so we did not know where it would take place. It just so happened we got the funding in Europe. But I remember we were talking about it, and way back then, I said, what do you think about Robin Wright? Would have been interesting, right? And then when Rick was, he sent me casting tapes, and an actress named Lily Taylor did the most amazing audition. She was in 6 Feet Under, do you remember? She did the most beautiful audition that was so rich. And I thought, God, maybe like, ah. So when Ethan Hawke got on board, he was a pretty hot actor because he had just done Reality Bites. And so when he was interested, I think Rick was very excited about that possibility. And then we started to reconfigure and we thought, well, what if we have this American meet a European? And Julie is a really good actress. She's just a fabulous actress. And she had done the movie White. They were the perfect age. They were both in their early 20s. So they were about the age we were thinking. And so we just thought, yeah, that works. Good actors, very intelligent. And we thought that'll be nice. Yeah, that'll work.
So calling back to my classmate, Iris's question in the discussion about the actors being the characters and the characters being the actors and how the characters were influenced by both you and Linklater. There's a scene in The Prodder where Jesse and Celine are walking and we hear Jesse's origin story about feeling like the world was never a place he felt he was meant to be.
I remember my mother once, she told me right in front of my father, they were having this big fight, that he didn't really want to have me. You know, that he was really pissed off when he found out that she was pregnant with me. You know, that I was this big mistake. And I think that really shaped the way I think. I always saw the world as this place where I really wasn't meant to be.
It's so sad.
Well, I mean, I eventually kind of took pride in it. You know, like my life was my own doing or something. You know, like I was crashing a big party.
Like he was crashing the big party. That has resonated with me from age 16. So is that monologue in Jesse's origin story, is that Linklater? Is that Ethan Hawke? Or is that Jesse?
I believe that's Rick Linklater. That sounds very Rick Linklater to me. He was that kind of guy where crashing the party, that sounds like something Rick might say. So I'm thinking that that's him, and I'm thinking that Ethan might have underscored that and added a few nuances to that, but that sounds really Rick to me.
I think he delivers that story about his past and his childhood with such authenticity. Like I don't even see the actor behind those lines. It's incredible.
Mm-hmm.
Thank you.
Yeah. Ethan Hawke's a great actor. So.
Was there any one night that you felt like was just really exciting that you came up with a clever line that you were really proud of, or a scene that just like felt like magic?
Well, I remember one thing that Rick came up with is that at the end of when we were wrapping it up and I walked in for one of our very last writing sessions, he said, I know how I want it to end. I want to visit the locations without, you know, in the daylight, and they're not there. And I thought that's extremely powerful, because do you know how it is when you've had a really like rich experience and then you go back to the place itself and you're like, was I really here with so-and-so? You know, it's haunting. It's haunting. You're looking for the feeling in the place itself. I remember that was really magical. I remember working in my house felt really good. We were tossing ideas back and forth. And I remember we were both writing in our notebooks, like we were just telling stories about love and our love lives and, you know, our childhoods and things like that. And occasionally one of us would go, you know, and I remember that felt really, it was very enjoyable and fun and relaxed. When we moved over to his apartment and we were sitting down at the computer, he would sit down and I would sit down, like we were having a conversation. While he would be sitting, I would be pacing around in his living room. And then while I was sitting, I think he was probably doing the same. And at some point in the evening, this was the middle of the night, we walked down to the convenience store, which was open all night. And I can't remember if it was like a Quickie Picky or a Piggly Wiggly, but, or, a, you know, they have these, or Circle K, they have these cute little, because this was in Austin, Texas, where we had these cute convenience store names. And I remember we would walk down and it was ritual. We would walk down, he would get a symphony bar and I would get a tab. And a tab, do you remember tab? Which was, they had discontinued tab, which was a sad day of mourning for me. But tab was a really intense, like a delicious Diet Coke. And so we would get fueled up in the middle of the night and we would just talk as we were walking. And it kind of felt before sunrise-y because it's the middle of the night and we're walking through a quiet neighborhood to the convenience store. And it just felt, you know, it felt like friends tossing ideas. It felt really good, you know?
I've actually got a question here from my cousin's husband, who I've told you about,
Rudy
Rodriguez. He's in Los Angeles right now. He wanted to know, he asked me to ask you, can you talk about how important set location is compared to the conversation? And does it hold the same amount of weight as the conversation itself?
In the case of our movie, that could have taken place anywhere. And we actually, as I told you, I wrote it, we wrote it to happen in America and thought that the conversations could take place in many, many towns. But there was something very special about Vienna because it's an extremely beautiful and romantic place. So it felt that it became a part of the, I think people are in love with, you know, that aspect of the story, even though it was kind of an accident and a fluke that it ended up being made there. It could have been made somewhere else. It just so happened that we had an offer for funding and I had been there and I knew that it was a beautiful and romantic place that kind of flew under the radar because it's got the incredible romance, but if people want that, they generally come to Paris. But Vienna is also a very special place. It did, in the end, I think, give us another layer that added to the story.
I'm wondering what, again, about like your relationship with when you were writing this script. What was it like for you? Because obviously Richard Linklater slightly based this off of like that girl he met in, I forget where, but that girl who met one night.
I was just at a toy store and I was in town for one night visiting my sister on my way back to Texas from New York. And this young woman was kind of flirting with me a little bit, or we had that little connection. And so I was bold enough to ask her, like, you know, when do you get off? Do you want to hang out after? She was like, sure, you know, I get off at 10. So we just ended up walking around Philly all night. And it was similar to the movie. I had to catch a plane the next morning. I remember 3 a.m, we're walking around and I'm saying, you know, I want to make a film about this. And she's like, what are you talking about? And I'm like, you know, this feeling, you know, this flirtation, this connection we're having, you know, I just think that's a movie.
And I always pictured Celine as this like idealization of that girl and like this like make-believe. So what was that relationship like with you to have this other woman who was so like in the middle, like you didn't know and no one really knew her? And she was like, was she, did you feel like there was any point where she was Celine, or did, was she all like, what was that relationship like with you and her, and this, like, what was that like? And then also, had that affect your relationship with him, if that makes any sense?
I think that a lot of mythology gets built up after a movie that's made. That's not true. Yeah.
Doesn't have this in her blood.
Yeah, I don't really know about that story. Yeah. I didn't really hear that story. Yeah. I don't know if that story is true.
It totally could be make believe.
Yeah. I think that romanticizing the making of a movie is a big deal.
Yeah.
If you like, I just generally don't believe the stories about the making of movies, because they want you to enter into the whole romance of the thing. What's really happening is usually not that pretty. It's a business. Like, people think, you know, being on a set is nothing but fun and you're in the world. No, it's work. It's hard work. And it's sometimes a boring place to be, you know, and it's repetitive. So I don't know. I didn't know her at all there. Yeah. If there was mention made of that, I don't think so, you know?
And then this is a much more basic question. But did you, like, was Celine ever, when you were originally going to have it in America, was Celine American, or was she always from Paris?
She would have been an American if it was made in America.
Wow. Okay.
A lot of people are very interested in the kind of philosophical background of love. And as the writer Before Sunrise, like where some of this originated. So Carla Gallegos says, hi, Kim. Carla from Mexico over here. Thank you so much for everything you have shared already. I know inspiration can come from many places, but in Before Sunrise, Celine's reflection on love as the attempt to truly understand another person felt deeply human and heartfelt. Could you share where that idea originated?
Oh, boy. Well, okay, I'm going to have to reference something else I did. I have a little bit of a part in Waking Life. I talk about language and about what language is an effort for us to connect and understand one another.
And this is where I think language came from. I mean, it came from our desire to transcend our isolation and have some sort of connection with one another. And it had to be easy when it was just simple survival, like, you know, water. We came up with a sound for that. Or saber-tooth tiger right behind you. We came up with a sound for that. But when it gets really interesting, I think, is when we use that same system of symbols to communicate all the abstract and intangible things that we're experiencing. What is like frustration? Or what is anger or love? When I say love, the sound comes out of my mouth and it hits the other person's ear, travels through this Byzantine conduit in their brain, you know, through their memories of love or lack of love. And they register what I'm saying and they say, yes, they understand. But how do I know they understand? Because words are inert. They're just symbols. They're dead, you know? And so much of our experience is intangible. So much of what we perceive cannot be expressed. It's unspeakable. And yet, you know, when we communicate with one another and we feel that we have connected, and we think that we're understood, I think we have a feeling of almost spiritual communion. And that feeling might be transient, but I think it's what we live for.
That bit from Waking Life is actually the opening introductory spiel I used to give to my writing students. So I think a lot about this idea that we can't connect perfectly. but we can attempt to connect through language, through words, through touch, through art, you know, through the songs we write, the stories we tell, conversations we have. And that's really what it comes, our experience on Earth is largely informed by our connections that we make with living things. I'm just thinking now, we have a perfumer in the class right now, and I sort of marvel that her she's connecting with plants. And I mean, I'm just thinking like, whoa, the level of that communication to connect with another living thing and to try to translate it, that's a beautiful thing. So I think that with this whole deal about the attempt, you know, it's all about the attempt. I think that's what I was trying to get at in the conversation in Before Sunrise, where she said, the attempt to connect, the attempt to communicate.
You know, I believe if there's any kind of God, it wouldn't be in any of us. Not you or me, but just this little space in between. If there's any kind of magic in this world, it must be in the attempt of understanding someone sharing something. I know, it's almost impossible to succeed, but who cares, really? The answer must be in the attempt.
We don't, you know, because we're locked in ourselves. We're in ourselves, and we have these tools, words. You know, they're just tools. And so we're hoping that we're understanding one another. We don't know if we're positive, but we're hoping that we understand one another. And if we feel that we have connected, even though it might be momentary, that is what we live for.
This has been Deviate with Rolf Potts. More about everything that was just mentioned, including information about Kim Curzon and the screenwriting class she'll be teaching with me in Paris this August, can be found in the show notes at rolfpotts.com/deviate. And as always, you can contact me with insights or questions at deviate@rolfpotts.com. This episode was produced by Cedar Van Tassel, and the video version was edited by Forrest Mallard, who also edited my video essay, Kansas Never Plays Itself. He does great video work, and you can find out more about his services in the show notes at rolfpotts.com/deviate. Thanks for listening, and I hope you tune in for future episodes of Deviate with Rolf Potts.